you're a California conservative, a libertarian, a moderate Democrat, believe in common sense, or just a sane person, this is the political podcast for you. It's the California Underground Podcast.
What's going on, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the California Underground Podcast. I'm your host, Phil. As always, with me is my trusty co-host, the best and fastest researcher in the West, Camille. And tonight we have a very special guest, Assemblyman James Gallagher. If you're aware of anything going on in California politics, you know who this guy is. He was one of the most vocal and outspoken critics of Gavin Newsom during the COVID pandemic. Him and Kevin Kiley took him to court and fought him there. Just a warrior up there in Sacramento. We need about 12 more or 20 more new James Gallaghers in Sacramento, in my opinion. So, James, the Honorable James Gallagher, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, hey, great to be with you, Phil and Camille. I'm glad we finally made this work out. I know last time I had some technical difficulties, but I told you I would get those worked out, and it looks like we're good. So glad to be with you guys tonight.
Thank you so much for being here. We're so excited.
Yeah, we got the technical difficulties worked out, coming in loud and clear. So for the small amount of people who have no idea who you are, why don't you give us a little introduction about yourself, where you're from, and how you got into politics?
Yeah, sure. So, I'm a husband and father. I've been married to my wife, Jana, for 20 years. We have 5 children. I got 2 girls, teenagers, and then 3 boys. Twins were last. They're 6. So we got a crew, and you know, I mean, that's a big reason why I do what I do is I'm a 6th generation Californian. I mean, I love this state. It's been, you know, really good to my family, and you know, this was the land of opportunity for my ancestors. And, you know, I've seen increasingly as I've grown up how it's losing that, you know, and especially now today as I'm in the assembly, you know, fighting battles, you know, against policies that I just think are really damaging and just taking away the luster of this great state. And for that next generation, you know, for my kids, for yours, you know, I think a lot of people are going, man, is California going to be, you know, a place where they can prosper? And increasingly that answer, it looks pretty bleak. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was a big reason why I got involved in politics. I'd say I've always kind of been interested, you know, growing up. I guess I was probably that kid that, you know, I loved history and civics. I'm proud that I got the Constitution Award when I was in 8th grade. you know, took that on into college and stayed pretty active. I went to UC Berkeley and was really involved with the College Republicans there and conservative politics, you know, and when I got my education and came back, started, you know, working in my hometown, decided to get involved, ran for local government first. I was on the Board of Supervisors in Sutter County, and then decided to, you know, take on Sacramento and run for assembly. So I've been doing that role for about 9 years, going into my 9th year in the assembly now. And last year I became our Republican leader, in the assembly. So, you know, I'm trying to bring things back, win seats. You know, I really want to turn the tide here in California, and just make things better.
One thing
go ahead,
Camille.
I was going to say, I'm stuck in the College Republican group at Berkeley. Like, I was like, is that an oxymoron that exists? Sorry.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's a great question. It's, you know, it's funny, like Berkeley's actually always had a pretty good, you know, over the years, it's had like a pretty good College Republicans group. When I got there, it wasn't very strong, but there was a group of us that, you know, just got more active. And I mean, by the time we graduated, there was about 300 members. Those weren't all active members, but we had, you know, we had built up the club and started a conservative magazine on campus. And it's kind of continued since then. I mean, you know, Berkeley, you know, generally has one of the better CR clubs. And I think they kind of, you know, that's where you kind of, you cut your teeth, right? Because you're battling, you're on the front lines of, you know, battling radical progressivism, you know, on the Berkeley campus. And so, yeah, it always has kind of had a pretty decent, strong student group on campus.
That was actually, it's funny, Camille, that was actually going to be my question was like, being in Berkeley and being part of the College Republicans, it probably does help sharpen your ability to argue. I found that out in law school. When you're in the minority, law school is very left-leaning. If you're conservative and you stand up in law school and you say, I'm conservative, you're going to get a lot of people shouting at you. So you better be able to like come with your A game when it comes to making your point and making your argument.
Yeah, that's true, man. I mean, I think the two things I learned, from Berkeley was, one, just, how to, hone your arguments and really, make your case against what is kind of the, established liberal progressivism on campus. But the other thing I'm kind of amazed about is like the things that we thought were pretty radical at Berkeley are starting to become more mainstream, and we're starting to see them, statewide, and they're coming into our politics. There's bills getting introduced that, I was like, man, that's just a crazy Berkeley thing. Well, now, with the way things have gone, we're seeing more and more of that try to get, pushed in, that agenda getting pushed into the mainstream.
Yeah. And I kind of want to go back a little bit. Speaking of making your case, I want to talk a little bit about you taking the Newsom administration to court during the COVID era, because I feel like that really catapulted you and Kevin Kiley into the limelight as these conservative warriors in California. Talk a little bit about that. Like, where did you guys decide, like, let's take them to court? And then what was that experience like? How much blowback did you get? How much support did you get while you were doing that?
Yeah, well, we had come back actually into session. So this was probably in like the, May timeframe of 2020. We had actually come back into session. The legislature came back from, essentially being back in their districts. And we were seeing like the governor just do these executive orders, like left and right, that I'm looking at, I'm going, that's lawmaking. You're making law out of whole cloth, or you're modifying and changing existing statute. And, immediately I went back to that eighth grade, constitution. I'm like, man, you cannot do that. This is a very simple, separation of powers issue. And I always said that from the beginning. I go, look, this is a simple, straightforward case. It's Constitution 101. Governor can't make law. So I was actually sitting in my law office, and I drafted up the complaint. I started drafting it right then. He had just issued the executive order, calling for all mail ballot elections, and also changing a lot of things about election law that people didn't even think about, like allowing you to, have a polling place in a bar, different things like that, that he just made, wholesale changes to. So I started drafting the complaint, put it together. And then I said, man, I'm going to need some help doing this. Who would be great, to have as a partner in this? And I immediately thought of Kevin Kiley. I called him, that day. I said, hey, man, I got this thing drafted up. What do you want to do? What do you want to go on this, law partners on this particular case, co-counsel? And he's like, absolutely. So like the next day, we got everything ready and went over and filed it in Sutter County Court together. And sort of the rest is history.
And what was you guys took him to trial, or what was the result of that?
Yeah, so the first thing we did is we actually went and got a temporary restraining order. So we did what's called an ex parte application, where we went into the court and said, look, it's very clear he's not allowed to do this. We want you to issue a restraining order stopping him from, executing this order. And we got it. So I think we were one of the first to get a temporary restraining order in COVID, during COVID, against, this abusive executive power. He and the attorney general's office immediately appealed, and they went to the Third District Court of Appeals, which we found was not a great venue for us. Most of the judges there are appointed. They're actually either former counsels to governors or served under governors, and then they're appointed by governors. Now they weren't all appointed by Gavin Newsom, but, governors over time. And so I would say there's very much a bias towards executive power. They overturned the restraining order. And then we went into the main case. And so that went to trial ultimately in October of 2020, which was kind of amazing in itself. We were able to kind of, we were expecting them to try to delay this as long as possible. But we were able to kind of get this on a fast track and get a trial date. And we won that. I mean, so at trial, we made our case. And, you know, I always say that when it was the only judge who was actually elected by the people and not appointed, you know, we won in Sutter County Superior Court. And it was a great decision. You know, Judge Sarah Heckman, you know, I encourage anybody to read it. We can get that out there for folks. But it goes into the fundamental principles and law of separation of powers and said, look, the governor did not have authority to modify, to change existing statute. So that was a big win. And the other great thing is we show up to the courthouse, and it's an amazing memory of just coming out of that courthouse and having just a bunch of people there in support, mm-hmm. you know, and people that were praying for us and people that were, you know, just there to help give us that support. And so many people that I think in our minds, we were just like, this is the right thing to do. It's what we have to do. It's not right. But the other thing we heard from so many people was, hey, thank you for doing this. Like, we're so glad that somebody is finally standing up against us, that we were doing something that so many people felt in their hearts and wanted to try and do something about, but just felt helpless about. And I think we gave a lot of people hope. And then there was so many other things that happened, you know, then some parents groups were going after on the schools issue. And I think it really turned into a movement, that, you know, was really great, you know, for California and for bringing people together to say, look, enough is enough. And we can't allow, you know, this to happen, you know, in our constitutional republic.
Yeah. I think that's actually a perfect segue into our next topic. In regards to standing up and saying enough is enough, we were talking a little bit about parental issues and people kind of pushing back on a lot of these issues. We talked about last week on the episode. You're seeing more of this parental pushback, especially in like Temecula, Chino Valley, of what's going on in schools and this idea that the school administrators and teachers know better than the parents and they want to kind of step in and be a wall and keep secrets from parents. What's been going on in Sacramento and what are your efforts regarding that from a legislative standpoint?
Yeah, so first, it's been amazing to see, you know, this movement of parents. And I give all the credit to them. You know, I mean, these groups that have formed really across the state, and they're just, you know, they're everyday, many of them women, you know, that are just saying, look, we're tired of what we were seeing in the schools, you know, kind of pushing either a woke curriculum, you know, or, I mean, during COVID, shutting down for far too long and keeping their kids at home, the mental health issues we were seeing with kids. And sort of this army of parents started showing up to school boards and saying, look, you know, we're going to pay attention. We've been asleep, but now we're going to pay attention and we're going to make sure that our kids are getting what they need and that they're getting an accurate education, that they're getting real history, not woke history. And to stop these agendas that are, you know, that people have seen are being pushed, you know, a radical transgender, agenda that's being pushed, so, you know, earlier this year, there were actually several lawsuits, but one high profile one was in Chico in my district, where a parent found out that the school was actually started transitioning, you know, her daughter at school and never told her at all. And so she brought a lawsuit against Chico Unified and said, look, this is a violation of my constitutional rights. Actually, Harmeet Dillon, who you guys probably know, you know, was doing the lawsuit for, was her attorney. And as we looked into this, we found that, you know, again, kind of going back to what we were talking about, there is no statute on the books in California that mandates schools not tell parents about their kid wanting to use a different bathroom or a different pronoun at school. It doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. But the California Department of Education was actually issuing guidances to the school district saying, this, you are required by law to do this. This is the guidance. You should do this. And if a kid tells you at school that they're transgender or that they want to use a different bathroom or they want to use different facilities, different pronouns, you do not tell the parents. So this was a total underground regulation, has no basis in law. And they were telling school districts to do this, including Chico. So Bill Asaley, my caucus member, assembly member, from Riverside, he actually ran a bill and I co-authored it to say, look, this should be mandatory that you tell parents. I mean, this is just among a whole host of other issues that you should tell parents about. If their kid is struggling at school, if they're being bullied, if they're having mental health issues, involve the parent. That should be the default, unless there's some issue of abuse, of course. Right. But, the default should be that you inform parents. So we ran that bill and we couldn't even get a hearing. It's AB 1314. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get a hearing in the education committee because the chairman, Al Maritsuchi, issued a letter saying, if I hear this bill, I would be giving a platform for hate. That's what he said. Completely ridiculous. So it's like, hey, man, we're representing the voices of common sense, reasonable parents around the state who are saying we should be involved. You can't exclude us. And so we've been pushing, to change that level. We couldn't even get a hearing. Now school districts, and the first one being, Chino, actually have now issued their own policy, doing just that, saying we're not going to follow this, underground regulation. There is no law saying that we can't tell parents, and we're going to tell parents. And so we're encouraging other school districts around the state. I'm encouraging school districts in my district to adopt the same policy and fight back, against, what is really an overreach of government.
Yeah. Newport Mesa, which is Orange County, tried to pass something similar. It failed. I'm surprised. Newport's primarily conservative. I think Costa Mesa, it's bigger. And so the split district there, I think that's probably the reason why it failed, unfortunately. So I think it's so interesting that we live in a society that supposedly we are innocent until proven guilty, but yet California is authoring all these bills that is making parents guilty before they've even done anything. We're all abusive. We're negligent. We don't know what we're doing. And the state needs to take care of our kids because we're all guilty of abuse and don't know what's best for our children.
Right. And there's a bill right now, AB 957, along those lines, that in a custody dispute, when a court's determining custody and as parents are going through a divorce, that this bill would provide that the court consider whether or not the parent affirms the child's gender identity, and make that like a factor for the court to determine in issuing custody. So like if you're a parent who says, look, I want to work through this issue with if my kid's going through gender dysphoria, I want to work through this issue, mental health therapy, all those things, but I don't want to affirm that because look, I don't think that's what's best for them to affirm them, in their chosen gender identity. Because look, like with a lot of things, kids don't really know, who they are, and they're still working through those issues in adolescence. This would penalize that parent. So a parent that's like lovingly trying to address the issues of their child, in a custody dispute would actually, have a mark against them for not being the parent that affirms. That's wrong, and it's sort of like trying to stack the deck against, parents for having a different viewpoint. And that's what we saw, like even when we introduced that bill and they wouldn't hear it, it's like, if you have a different viewpoint, shut up, you can't even talk.
Yeah.
Shut down.
Where is that one at?
That bill is coming. I think it's in the Senate right now. And it'll be voted on by the full body of the Senate. And then if it passes there, it's going to come over to the Assembly again. So in this kind of last month of session that's coming up, that's one we're going to see on our side. And then also the other one that's got a lot of attention, and that was the issue in Temecula with the school district down there, is trying to force textbooks, woke textbooks on school districts, and the governor talks all this game about, people are banning books. He wants to force books, force you to teach only certain things. He wants to force an agenda and ideology on all school districts, Instead of letting local school districts make those decisions on what their curriculum is going to be, what textbooks they're going to use, as has always been the case and should be the case, that this should be a local control issue up to the school districts in their communities to determine.
How should most things be left up to local government? But I almost wonder, like, has Gavin even gone to that district? Does he come down here? I mean, he's up there in Sacramento, or he's in the other red states.
But no, Gavin's trying to use it. The
Temecula.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, he's never been there, and he's trying to use this issue, to further his own political ambitions. He thinks it's something that, he can motivate his base on. We all know he's running for president. I mean, it's so obvious that, he doesn't care about his own state because it's a dumpster fire, homelessness, crime rising, mental illness, people on the streets that are open drug use. I mean, there's nothing that he can tout upon his record in California that's positive. So he tries to play in these cultural wars. And this is kind of the latest one where he's like, I'm going to buy the textbooks. I'm going to buy the textbooks for them, and I'm going to charge them, and I'm going to fine them. Whether you like it or not, like same old Gavin, right? But just trying to get attention, not actually trying to understand the issue there, which is actually much more nuanced.
I was enjoying kind of using the left's words against them that past week, where Gavin was kind of sticking his nose into stuff and overriding local officials, saying that Gavin Newsom is a threat to our democracy, because he's basically saying, I'm king, sovereign. You have to listen to me. You guys can't have local officials. You can't have your local control. It doesn't matter. Everything should come down from Sacramento. So it's interesting. They like to claim that everything's a threat to democracy that threatens them. But when they actually threaten democracy, no, it's all fine as long as it pushes their own agenda.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that rich coming from this guy, right? With all the mandates that he did, executive orders, bypassing democratic processes, totally bypassing the legislature. And then, this is the guy who we voted on the death penalty twice with direct democracy, with everybody voting on it. And the people have upheld the death penalty twice in recent history. And this guy decided, hey, I don't really care what the democracy thinks in California. I'm going to end the death penalty by fiat. I mean, this guy has no business talking about democracy, and civil rights that he stepped on, throughout COVID and then continue to use his executive powers, even after the emergency was long over, to step on and tread on people's rights. I mean, so, yeah, he has no business talking about that. It's laughable. The problem is the guy's got such a bully pulpit, and he's so great at spinning things, is that, he's able to get out there and get his message out there. And there hasn't been a lot of questioning. I'd say more recently media is starting to kind of push back on him and question him, but he's kind of had free rein to do that for a while.
Real quick, I want to kind of dive into that a little deeper, but someone in the chat just said, my son's stepsister moved to North Carolina to get her daughter away from teachers trying to transition her at school here in California. I think it was Citrus Heights School, middle school. So someone in the chat personally knows that this is happening in schools.
It's crazy. I mean, look, that's the fundamental thing here, man, is do you believe that school officials should be able to transition your kids at school without you knowing about it and to keep it secret from you? Absolutely not. And I think overwhelmingly people agree with that sentiment. They want to try and make it about, oh man, you are trying to, go after transgender youth, that you're trying to discriminate, you're taking away their privacy rights. No, what it fundamentally is about is that parents are in control of their kids' education, of their upbringing, of their health care, their mental health. They're in control, not the school, not some agenda that comes out of Sacramento, not some assemblyman like Corey Jackson, who's trying to push this kind of stuff, in the assembly and force, his view of how things should be on all schools. Like, look, it's the parents. Parents get to make those decisions, and they should be fundamentally in control. And I think, as this issue goes into November and it's talked about in the election, I think it's going to be a very compelling issue, and I think it will help swing a lot of districts, you know, depending on, hey, are you going to be with the parents, you know, or are you with, you know, the government and this radical agenda?
Yeah, I definitely think it's, you know, you're in Sacramento, and before I get to this next point, if you're in the chat or you're watching, make sure you ask your questions or comments to the assemblyman. I think you see these bills coming out, and I wonder behind the scenes how many, you know, Republicans are all most likely on the same page, but I'm wondering how many Democrats there are who, once this kind of, you know, the rubber meets the road, are they going to back this when they know it's such a third rail of politics right now and they're going to get massive pushback? What's your kind of take on what's the temperature of Sacramento about these bills?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm hoping for, you know, is that I think that there's a lot of these, you know, I think there's a lot of parents speaking up. I think there's a lot of constituents contacting their assembly member and talking about these issues, and also a lot of other issues. Like, you know, what are you doing to address the fentanyl crisis that's killing our kids, right? Mm-hmm. What are you doing about crime, which is rampant and everybody's experiencing it? And it sort of puts a lot of these Democrats, you know, on. It helps keep them honest. It keeps them accountable. So how are you going to vote on these issues? And however you vote, you are going to be held accountable come November. And I think as this pressure builds, I am at least hopeful that we'll see, you know, many Democrats kind of come over and either vote against these bills or maybe just abstain from them, which could ultimately help stop, you know, some of these bad bills from actually gaining passage and becoming law.
Going off that topic of fentanyl, you've been doing a lot of work on fentanyl. Why don't you tell us what's going on in terms of fentanyl and your kind of battle legislatively with that?
Yeah, I mean, this is another one that just is like, it boggles the mind. We have a serious crisis on our hands. We have for at least the past 3-4 years with fentanyl. I mean, it's killing our kids. We have kids that, you know, take a pill that they think is maybe a Percocet. It ends up being fentanyl laced. They take one pill and they die. You know, we're seeing it on our streets, you know, people dying on the streets from fentanyl overdoses, you know, over 100 a week now, I believe is what it is that we're seeing. And, you know, I would say like for the last few years, Republicans have been trying to push bills, you know, to try and get more penalties on dealers, on the, you know, the people who are peddling this poison. And then this year we've had Democrats who've actually stepped up and even introduced bills. You know, one being Alexandra's law, which would have, it's really simple. This is a very simple and should be a very common sense bill. If you've actually already dealt fentanyl laced pills and you killed someone, then you get what's called a Watson advisement that, hey, if you do this again, you could be charged with murder. Right. So this is saying like, hey, if the second time you go and do this, you could then be charged with murder. And that's all it is an advisement. And then it allows the prosecutor to do that. That bill couldn't even get out of Senate Public Safety. It was a Democratic author, Tom Umberg. It had 21 co-authors in the Senate, which means it has a majority support in the Senate. And this Public Safety Committee in the Senate wouldn't pass it out. So it got stopped in its tracks. And we've just seen this time and time again, these public safety committees, like last,
like, you know, SB 14,
it's, you know, so child trafficking, you know, like, are you kidding me?
I mean, it was like the same terms, like second time.
Right. Yeah. Again, like something that's very like, are we going to go after the perpetrators of crime who are doing horrendous things to our kids, trafficking, enslaving kids and selling them for sex, or, you know, or killing people with these fentanyl laced pills? Why can't you bring yourself? And the great thing is it's finally getting the exposure that it's needed. I would say these guys have been doing this for at least the last 10 years, like killing bills that should pass, that are good public safety measures. And it's all because of this radical view that they have, which is there should be no new penalties for crime. We have too many people in prison and we should let everybody out, you know, with really no rehabilitation whatsoever. And think that we're just going to talk these people into, like, you know, not committing crimes anymore. That's their view. They really believe that. And so, and they've had, you know, the power, and they've pushed these policies through, and now we're seeing the results of them. We have people getting out who are committing crime, atrocious crimes against people, mass shootings, and it's all because of this policy. But now it's finally getting exposure, and people are seeing, you know, that the emperor has no clothes here, right? And I think that's going to make a difference, you know, that people are going to say, look, we're tired of that. We need real public safety. We need common sense measures. And so we've been able to, I think we've been able to really expose that. We've gotten some measures through, you know, this year. But the big one on fentanyl is like, we need real penalty for the dealers. So if you're found with a bunch of pills, fentanyl-laced pills, there should be real serious penalties so that you can't be victimizing people anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely in that umbrella of like kitchen table politics that I think California Republicans can really grab a hold of in terms of parental rights, public safety. And Democrats are just failing right now. And I think they've gone down this road of being loose on crime and being the compassion party that says, well, we got to be soft on crime and soft on the criminals. But now it's like come home to roost, and you see it in San Francisco. You see it in Oakland. You see these cities being absolutely overrun. I mean, it's like a Batman movie. Like it's just gotten so bad with crime that it's, you Gotham just look at it and go, it's exactly like Gotham City. I mean, you see this stuff and you go, these cities have collapsed under the weight of crime. I mean, London Breed is like, she's trying her best to get her hands around it now, but it's like too little too late. She was soft on crime when she was locked.
She's like a reborn crime fighter, right? Now she's like, yeah, we're going to go after there. We're going to get tough on people. And they're like, well, hey, man, like you created this situation.
Exactly.
You supported pretty much everything. Yeah.
Do they not realize this? Your policies did this.
What happened, by the way, to all the, wasn't there this like big offensive or front of like, there was going to be CHP and National Guard and like,
right,
this coordinated effort? I haven't heard anything about that. Is that another Newsom publicity stunt where he had like, I'm going to bring in all these different organizations and law enforcement to clean up San Francisco? And I haven't seen any of it. So
Newsom's going to fly in as Batman.
Not at all, Newsom. Man. Yeah, I mean, I saw he made that big announcement, and then you see like, well, what actually happened? I was actually thinking about actually going out on the street and like doing some video, like, hey, you guys seeing CHP? Have they been cracking heads around here or what? Like, you know, I was in San Francisco not too long ago, and I didn't really see any evidence of it, man. Like, I saw the open air drug sites. Mm-hmm. You know, these cartel type folks, I can't remember, you know, there's been stories about that. These people are actually, you know, committing burglaries and theft on the street, and they're kind of been left to just kind of run rampant. I guess they're, you know, London Breed is talking about cracking down on these kind of, you know, cartel like groups. But I certainly didn't see any evidence of this big crackdown, and we're still seeing overdose deaths every day in San Francisco. And again, it's a natural result of their policies, which have decriminalized, you know, drugs, decriminalized crime, and really had no penalties or accountability if you're victimizing people. You know, it's the other one in the Bay Area that's terrible, like Asian hate, you know, like people walking up to elderly Asian people and just punching them in the face, you know. You know, it's rampant because there's no accountability for crime. And a lot of the Asian community in the Bay Area has really been, you know, voicing this, like going to town halls saying, will somebody do something about this? You know, they have a woke DA there, Pamela Price, who, again, doesn't prosecute crime, doesn't believe in prosecuting crime. They had an infant boy who was killed by cross gunfire, you know, in the area. And there's still has been really no result, no real action on that. So a lot of the, you know, the Asian community, API community is saying, look, what are you doing to actually, you know, stop this rampant hate crime that's going on, you know, in our communities? And because of this radical worldview that they have, they're not seeing the results. But again, I think we're seeing a counterstroke, you know, where people are rising up and saying enough is enough.
Pamela Price, who I believe is facing a recall right now. So power of the recall to get rid of some of these woke DA, soft on crime. As the leader of the Republican Assembly Caucus, is there a lot of talk in terms of strategy and reaching out to voters in California about a lot of these kitchen table issues and kind of saying like, look, here's our solution. We're completely different than Democrats. We're not just doing Democrat light. Like, we have bolder, these are conservative solutions, and like, we're going to go after these kitchen table politics or kitchen table issues, I should say.
Yes. And so, I mean, this, when I came in as leader last year, so it was in February, the big thing I said is like, guys, we've got to go on the offensive. You know, like we've always been on, you know, the defensive, on our heels, like responding to what the Democrats are doing. We have to start saying, hey, here, let's put things out there that we want to do and make them be the ones that say no. And so you probably saw that it started with the gas tax suspension. We're saying, look, repeal the gas tax right now. We have $100 billion surplus. People are struggling to pay at the pump. The least we could do is take the tax off of it, which would have saved everybody instantly, you know, on gas money. And so we pushed that, and the Democrats said no. You know, they continually voted against it. And we use that as an issue of, I think, a very strong issue with voters to say, look, they don't want to give you relief. You know, Gavin came out and said, we're going to give you rebate checks, right? And I think people laughed at that. And, you know, they couldn't even get you the rebate checks out. It took forever to get them out to people. And when they were, you know, very small. It didn't really hardly put a dent in what they were paying and at the pump.
My wife actually, she actually found a rebate check. Like, I was going through a stack of papers and I was cleaning the office, and I look and I go, honey, do you know you have one of these like stimulus cards or whatever she got? She goes, oh, I thought this was like a scam or something. And I was like, no. And I looked it up and I was like, yeah, this is legit. It was like, so we got the $200. We didn't spend it on gas. So we took ourselves out for a nice date night. Thank you, Gavin Newsom.
Yeah,
talking about
going on the offensive. You probably couldn't go to the French Laundry though, right, Phil?
No, I mean, I think we'd get through one appetizer. That's probably about all we could get through at the French Laundry. But then again, I'm not best friends with an oil and gas industry lobbyist, like whatever, is it Richard Kenny? Is that his name? His Gavin's good buddy. But besides the point, that is like so refreshing to hear this idea of going on the offensive, because anybody who's listened to me talk about this and ramble on it for a long time, I've been saying this about California Republicans for a long time, and Camille could probably attest to this. You have to go on the offensive because you have to frame the argument and make Democrats argue in your frame. And when you're always reactionary, you're arguing in their frame. And when that happens, you're going to lose 9 times out of 10. So when you set up the argument, Democrats are going to lose because you've already set the argument. You've set the tone of what it's going to be about. So exactly with like the gas tax, you took the offensive and said, look, you're getting taxed. You need relief. It's already expensive. Make the Democrats argue that point back. And I thought that, you know, that's a great, refreshing move to see California Republicans do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's exactly what we have been doing. The other, so more broadly, we announced this thing called the California Promise. And we put that out there. Hey, here are the lists of proposals that, you know, that we would do. And we kind of broke it down into some categories. Like, here's what we would do to actually cut your costs, like affordability issues, right? Here's what we would do on homelessness. You know, instead of having this enablement strategy, we would have an empowerment strategy. Get people off the street, get them into services and treatment if they want it, right? But otherwise, like, we need to start enforcing on encampments, right? We shouldn't have encampments next to schools, next to childcare centers. And we had a bill that actually did that and ran that bill and made them be the ones to say no, right? Then on crime and public safety, we say, hey, here's the things we would do to hold criminals accountable. We would get rid of these emergency credits, you know, these credits that let people get out of prison, you know, years before their sentence is up. Reverse that policy and say, no, you actually have to show us that you're rehabilitated, that you're actually doing things to change, you know, your mindset and your way of life. And so we put out like, hey, here's our alternative policies. We ran bills along those front. And then this year, like, you know, the fentanyl, we've run fentanyl bills. They've said no. So we've exposed that and showed them, you know, for who they are. SB 14, you know, you guys don't want to crack down on, you know, child traffickers. Okay, well, everybody needs to know that. And we'll take this into November and we'll take our case to the voters and let them decide. And I think, you know, the more we can do that, you know, to your point, the more we can really show just how radical they are and how they are saying no and how they're the ones that are really in the way of, you know, good policy, you know, the more that I think we're going to be successful at the ballot box.
Yeah, and it's, in my mind, at least in my humble opinion, I think voters vote for things rather so much than against things. And I think when they're thinking about their lives and these kitchen table issues, they want to vote for a solution, not just a party that goes, well, we're not Democrats. Okay, well, that doesn't mean anything that you're not Democrats. The Democrats are promising X, Y, and Z, whether they can actually get it done or not, or just blowing smoke. It's something. So I think it's got to be more substantive where there is that, this is what we're going to do, and this is our substantive answer to that. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, you can't be the one saying, hey, I just don't like what the Democrats are doing. Right. Like,
yeah.
Which there's plenty of material there, right? Like, there's plenty of things that they're failing at, but then you got to show, hey, what would you do differently? And I think that's what, you know, voters are looking for. So that's what we're trying to provide.
Yeah. I point out the issue, but give me your solution.
I think the other thing we battle too is, you know, a lot of times like mainstream media, it's hard to get our message in there, right? Because it's like, like I said, Gavin's got the bully pulpit. He does a press conference and it always gets covered. You know, the Democrats kind of have the advantage there. And so we've just really tried to push, like, how can we get our message out? How do we get earned media? But then also, how do we get our message out in alternative media? You know, so, you know, talking to folks like yourselves on, you know, on podcasts, on, you know, social media, like really trying to, we've certainly bumped up and boosted our messaging on different forms of social media, just to try and make sure that we can get that message out. Cause that is a challenge. I mean, it is a challenge when you're in the minority party. But it's something that I put an emphasis on because look, if they don't know what you're doing, if people don't hear what you're doing, they don't know what you're doing, then it didn't happen. Right.
Yeah.
And we don't want to be in that situation. So I appreciate you guys, you know, for really covering a lot of these different topics, and you've got a huge following, and it helps get, you know, people information that they may not otherwise hear.
Oh. Thank you.
Oh, we appreciate that. Thank you. One bill that I specifically want to talk about, and we talked about before, is SB2, which is regarding concealed carry. And California has been doing their darndest to basically outlaw concealed carry. And as a concealed carry holder, this worries me, because they just don't believe anybody should defend themselves with a gun. Even when crime is rampant all over California, you shouldn't be able to protect yourself. Tell us a little bit about that, because I know a lot of our listeners are Second Amendment supporters.
Yeah, well, let me start with this background, man, which is like, was it 2 years ago, we had a shooting near blocks from the Capitol, mass shooting, basically gang related, you know, gang related. This guy had a weapon he was not supposed to have. He was a felon who was not supposed to have a firearm. But he had a history of stealing weapons, stealing guns, modifying them, you know, throughout his history. And of course he did it again. He actually also got out of prison. He was supposed to do 10 years for domestic, like serious domestic violence against his girlfriend. He got out of 4 years because of the automatic credits. This guy gets out on the street, shoots up downtown Sacramento, kills 5 people. That's the problem. And we're seeing that across the state, man. Like that happened in the Bay Area, you know, a few months back, 2 drive-by shootings. They never want to talk about that, right? Instead, they go after like, well, hey, let's talk about concealed carry people. Okay, let's talk about them. There's been exactly 1 homicide involving a CCW holder in the last 10 years. 1.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, most of the time, the MO for these shootings is criminals who have a criminal past. They're not supposed to have guns. They're prohibited from having guns, but they have them. And Rob Bonta and the Department of Justice has done very little to get guns out of their hands. Instead, he wants to make this his big thing, right? Let's go after concealed carry holders who are law-abiding citizens who are literally going to their sheriff and getting a permit, you know, so that they can, you know, conceal carry. you know, let's go after them. And it's also, it also arises out of this Supreme Court case, right? Because this U.S. Supreme Court said, hey, you can't do this stuff, man. You can't have these, you know, very arbitrary rules that infringe on people's Second Amendment rights. So in the aftermath of that case, they're trying to push this bill to, one, consolidate and say, hey, the rules are going to be uniform in every county, and you got to go through all these, this whole rigmarole to actually get the permit to carry, and then establish all these places where you will not be allowed to conceal carry. It's pretty much, they've named pretty much every public place possible so that you essentially could not carry in almost any place, you know,
right,
including churches.
Exactly.
You know, and, you know, so look, there's some big constitutional issues with this, but they're trying to push this legislation this year. And I just think it's completely misguided because CCW holders are not the problem. And that is, that's a fact. And moreover, you are infringing on people's constitutional rights who often need to carry guns to protect themselves from the dangerous criminals that you guys, the Democrats, have let out onto our streets and are, you know, are victimizing people on the street, are victimizing businesses. You know, if you're in a church, I mean, I know of churches where, you know, the ushers carry, and they carry because, you know, we've had incidents of people coming in and shoot and trying to shoot up churches.
Right.
And they want to be able to defend themselves, and they are law abiding citizens, and they should have the right to do so. And so it, to me, it's just, it's completely frustrating. It is misguided. We managed to stop that bill last year. I think it's going to be a fight this year to stop it because they only need a majority this year. They were trying to pass it on an urgency basis last year, so they needed 2/3. Now they're just going to do it as a regular bill, not an urgency measure. And so it's probably going to get out. I hate to say it's probably going to get out, and we're going to need to take it to court, which the good news is we've had some success in the courts at overturning these type of unconstitutional laws.
What always baffles me is it's illegal to murder. I mean, it's already, that's illegal to murder. And so then these people go and murder, and then they go to prison for a day, and they, you know, let them out with a slap on the wrist and like, don't do that again. And then they act shocked when it happens again. And then they're like, oh gosh, people are shooting people. We should pass more laws so that those that have literally gone through training and background checks and extensive stuff for like, what, a year, Phil, 18 months to get your CCW, they're like, oh, they're the problem. Not the person that already murdered someone that we released from jail with a slap on their wrist. They're not the problem. So, you know, this law that, you know, don't murder people in cold blood, that's not good enough. We just need to make sure that law-abiding citizens can't protect themselves against the crazy murderers that we refuse to keep in jail.
Exactly, man. I mean, and that's, you know, and that, again, it just goes back to that same story. When there's no accountability for crime, and you have no, look, they, no joke, a couple years ago, they took away the sentencing enhancement for using a gun in the commission of a crime. They took that away. You know, it was a mandatory like sentencing enhancement if you used a gun in the commission of a crime. These same Democrats took that away. So who's responsible for gun violence in California? It's the Democrats. You know, they're the ones that don't want to punish those who are actually victimizing people with guns on our streets. And you know, it's not CCW holders, you know, so, you know, I'm going to be fighting, you know, with everything I can to stop SB2, from moving forward. And if not, like, I think we need to take it to the courts as we have been able to do, and get it overturned there.
I think the most ironic story was when Karen Bass had her guns stolen from her safe.
Right. Unbelievable. Right. I also wanted to, I don't know if it ever came out like, hey, did you have those, you know, properly locked up, you know, and all this, because they always emphasize that too, like, oh, people aren't really storing their guns properly. Like, did she?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that ever really came out. But literally that is the problem, you know, is, you know, these aren't, people doing this are not going, you know, most often they're not people that are going to the gun shop and going through all the process and everything. It's people stealing weapons on the streets or buying them on the black market. And that's really where the focus, you know, should be on.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a tough hurdle, and even here in San Diego, that like is actually pretty good on CCW. Shout out to Gun Owners of San Diego, did an incredible job, actually pushing for lax CCW or easier CCW. You have to go through the whole process. I mean, it's background checks. You have to go through the sheriff's department, and like then you have like 8 hours of training, and it's not easy. And then they, even right now, before a bill, like if hypothetically SB 2 gets passed, there's so many regulations you have to learn. Okay, you can't take it here. You can't take it here. You can't take it into a bar. You can take it into a restaurant that has a bar. Like, so you have to constantly be thinking, okay, I have to follow all of these regulations and restrictions, so I'm abiding by the law and I'm very careful because I don't want to get my Second Amendment right taken away. So yeah, and it's always the most law-abiding citizens who end up getting their CCW and following the laws, and then they're penalizing the CCW who follow the law to a T, and not the criminals who show up anywhere with a gun. They don't care about restrictions on where you can and cannot carry.
Right. Next, you're going to have like tracking devices on your gun so they know where it is at all times. I shouldn't give any ideas.
I mean, they keep coming up with new bills, but you know, the bottom line is they passed a lot of bills, you know, over the years. And yet I point out, you know, gun crimes are on the rise. California right now has a trend of 44 mass shootings a year. You know, now they'll say, hey, we are better than other states. Okay, but you still have a pretty serious problem. And, you know, maybe you need to think about, maybe it's not, you know, these gun laws, it's the criminal. And it's like going after, you know, and having, you know, accountability. So, And I think more and more people are waking up to that as well.
I wanted to return to this topic, and I just wanted to see if there's a sense in Sacramento, in the legislature, about whether there's a growing sense that Newsom really is running for president. Because on this program, we absolutely believe he's running for president, but I don't know what happens in the halls of Sacramento, if that's the feeling or those the whispers or...
Yeah, man, like, I'll say, like, there's a lot of Democrats who may not come out and say it publicly, but they are frustrated with Newsom. And their frustration is really like, hey, this guy is only about himself. Like, you know, he's always just trying to get press for himself, you know, and doesn't really work with the legislature, even Democrats, on, you know, trying to get, you know, good policy established. He's all about Gavin and his agenda, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's been increasingly more obvious that like he's not paying attention to the state. He's not being really serious about policy issues. The only time he does is when he uses it for a press conference and an announcement. So you saw that on infrastructure, right? He's doing these bills to streamline infrastructure and we're going to remove the barriers. Yeah, well, man, you've been governor, you know, for, you know, going on 6 years now, and you haven't even built any new water storage, even though we passed a bond in 2014. You could have done a lot of things, but now he announces it just so because he doesn't want to look bad, right? Mm-hmm. And we got embarrassed on SB 14, right? When people are saying, man, why isn't, you know, your legislature passing a bill dealing with, you know, child traffickers. And immediately he starts, you know, going out there, oh yeah, I've talked to Shannon Grove and I'm trying to make sure this passes because he knows it hurts his presidential ambitions. Mm-hmm. And so, look, I think it's very clear what he's trying to do is either set himself up for when Joe Biden gets pushed out, so that he can be the candidate in this year's presidential, or if not, he's helping establish himself for 2028. Either way, like he is definitely every day Gavin Newsom looks in the mirror in the morning, and as he puts in the gel, he thinks that's the next president of the United States. You know, I mean, there's no doubt about it. But the frustrating thing is there's nothing wrong with having ambition. But when you are following that to the detriment of your own state and not taking care of the real problems facing your state, homelessness, crime, fentanyl, you're not really making any real inroads on those issues. That's a travesty. And it needs to be called out more. Hopefully it will. And if this guy gets out there, and I still say, man, if this guy runs for president, I don't see anybody in the Midwest and the Rust Belt, you know, in these blue collar states saying, yeah, that's what I want is, you know, the California, what does he call it? The California for all. They definitely don't want that. They don't want what he's selling, right. I think, in other states. So I think he'd have a real hard time. But he definitely, you know, it's pretty clear he's trying to set himself up to run for president.
I imagine apologize. My dog is very barky. Sorry.
That's fine. I imagine he's like Patrick Bateman in American Psycho, blowing kisses to himself and winking at himself while he's getting ready every morning. Like, ooh, here's the next president.
Well, now we can't unsee that.
Well, you know, I wouldn't be the first person who compared him to Patrick Bateman from American Psycho. So just standing upon the shoulders of giants. So we're coming up on the hour now. And I want to give you like the last word in terms of like what your goals are in assembly right now and as assembly leader. And, you know, let the listeners know what you're working on and how they can support you in all this and keep in touch.
Well, look, I think the thing I'd say, man, as we're closing here is I think we're at a turning point, you know, in California. And the stakes are pretty high, you know, like we have to start shifting if we want to see, you know, the California that we've always loved and known. And, you know, when it comes to our education, our kids are not reading at grade level. We've got to reform education in the state and make it work for kids, number one, and empower parents. We have got to turn the tide on crime. It's out of control. We need to start making crime illegal again, as my friend Kevin Kiley coined last year. And look, we need to really do something about homelessness. It's, you know, like this enablement strategy that lets people do drugs and camp out on the streets. It is so flawed and it has destroyed our cities, you know? So we have an opportunity to change that. And what I would say is, like, I think for a long time, people have been voting Democrat. Maybe that's the cool thing to do. You know, maybe people have just had a bad taste in their mouth about Republicans. But it's time to change the state, and Republicans are the ones who are trying to, you know, who have the ideas and to change this around and to have, you know, real solutions to these problems. And so I just want, you know, take a look at us, man, and help our candidates get across the finish line. We have good Republican candidates that are running in every assembly district in this state. And I would just really encourage people, hey, stay involved. I know a lot of your listeners, man, they're engaged. They're staying involved in their local school districts and, you know, local governments. But stay engaged, but then also like get out there and help us, you know, win some seats, because unless you win elections, you can't change policy, right? You can't govern. And check out, you know, our California Promise. We put things out there so they can go to the website, which is asmrc.org/California Promise. If you check out that website, that kind of shows some of the things we've been working on. You know, look, we're just going to keep working hard. We're going to keep trying to put our message out there. And like I said, go on the offensive, talk about the things that we want to do and make the Democrats say no and hold them accountable in November.
Awesome. So where can people find you and follow you to keep up with you?
So I'm on Twitter, you know, so you can find me on Twitter, also Facebook, Instagram, I could send out a thing on all the different handles there, but you can look me up. So Assemblyman James Gallagher, you know, on any of those social media links, you can find me. And then I also have, you know, my own website that's, you know, talking about some of the stuff I'm doing in terms of bills and legislation as well. But yeah, I mean, definitely follow us, you know, and follow my colleagues, you know, in your districts. You know, you have different Republicans potentially representing you. Follow what they're doing as well. And let's just keep, you know, stay engaged. Don't give up on California, because I do think we're at a place where we can start turning the tide here and getting back to a reasonable middle in this state.
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
What would you say to California voters who are discouraged and believe their vote doesn't matter? How would you encourage them?
Well, I mean, the easiest way to make that a reality is to not vote, right? Is to give up on the process altogether. I mean, if you don't vote, then there's no way we'll change it, right? And so mm-hmm. I hear that a lot from folks, and I get it, man. There's different issues that make people frustrated or feel like, man, am I really going to make a difference? The state's so blue. But as more and more people are waking up, and I'm telling you, people in the, you know, in the center, independents and Democrats are starting to say, man, we've had enough. And if we all band together and we all vote and try to make change, like, I believe it's going to happen. So don't give up hope. Stay engaged. This is a big, you know, big cycle here, 2024, where we can make some change. And I would just say, hey, hang in there, stay engaged, and definitely do whatever you do, make sure you get out and vote. You know, don't be part of, you know, sort of that. You don't want to wake up and say, hey, man, I didn't even vote. I didn't even try to change things. That's the only sure way that things will never change.
Right. I notice you haven't gotten used to calling it X yet and not Twitter, because I still call it Twitter.
That was so weird. I mean, it did confuse me just the other day, like, because I was like, where is the Twitter? I mean, where is the Twitter, you know, label on my phone?
Yeah,
my app. I was like, and then my son's like, hey, dude, it's X. He's like, didn't you know that it changed? I didn't know. I actually didn't. So, yeah, so X. You can find me on X.
Yeah, I keep looking for it, and I'm like, I'm looking for the iconic blue and white bird, and then I'm like, where is my Twitter app? And it's just the black X.
I know, it was.
Mine hasn't updated yet, but that I actually was going to bring that up a few minutes ago. We were talking about San Francisco. Like, of all their issues, apparently the big X on the building was their big complaint. It's like, there's homeless people blocking your view of the X, but okay.
Right. Hey, there's people over there, like, smoking crack. Right, like, in the street.
Not funny, you know? But
yeah.
X is, I mean, is
but you're worried
issue.
About an X. Okay. An
X.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, James, thank you for coming on. As always, the door is open. There was a ton of stuff we could have talked about tonight, and we couldn't get to all of it in an hour. So the door is open. Whenever you want to come back on and talk more, welcome you back
Absolutely.
Anytime. So thank you for coming on.
We'll do it again. Yeah,
technical difficulties, none happened tonight, so we're good there, loud and clear. And yeah, as I end every show, best way to support this show for free is to share it with a friend, message it, post it on X, if that's what you like to call it, Facebook, all that stuff. Share it with anybody, so make sure you like, share, subscribe, review, all of that stuff, and yeah, we'll see you on the next one. Have a good night, everybody.